Welcome to the Dawn of Crime. It has been such a long time since I've done an upload, and here we are doing a podcast yet again. I've had a couple of people lately ask me when the next podcast is coming out, so let this be it. I've got some really exciting stuff I'll talk about shortly, I'll try and justify why it's been so long since I've done an upload podcast for you guys. I published the second edition of the Squizzy Taylor biography, which I published in 2020, the first time I published it. And then I went through it again to update a whole bunch of stuff. Maybe as much as 40% of it was inaccurate, but I only discovered that after I published it. You see, what happened was when I began the process of trying to put together the Squizzy Taylor biography, I had quite a few things that really made it very difficult from the outset, right? I'll go through them. When you compare Squizzy Taylor to, I don't know, Al Capone, Bonnie and Clyde, Ned Kelly, the Cray twins, right? These people all dominated the media in their own times, right? So there was maybe as much as a 20-year period between 1907 and 1927 when Squizzy was really active, when almost for a bulk of that, not a week would go past where you wouldn't have a Squizzy Taylor story nationally. There were times when there was like just two newspapers in the day. So you'd have the Herald in the morning. No, mate, it was the Sun in the morning and then the Herald at night. And both of them have different Squizzy Taylor stories. But the reason he hadn't been written about and biographied as extensively as the others is because you had this situation where he was so overly active that capturing a full essence of all that he contributed to in one book is incredibly difficult. To do that, I had to read like 30,000 newspaper articles. I'm not exaggerating. So you go through the archive called Trove, which has all the newspaper articles, and you start with the first search, which is Leslie Taylor. And you read whatever's there, then you go through it again as Joseph Leslie Taylor, and then you do another variation. Then you come back to Squizzy Taylor, because some newspapers didn't refer to him as Leslie at all, and so forth. So you end up with this kind of having to research the thing three or four times. And then on the back of that, once you've got all the information, right, the size of his crimes are just enormous. So when you get somebody like Ned Kelly, probably a good example, Ned Kelly is known for, you know, half a dozen big things. So he writes a very famous letter called the Jewelry Letter. He writes it with a group of people that he's held up. He tries to derail a train. He is involved with a police shooting. He's a horse thief. And then there's the last stand at Glen Rowan, and then he's hung, right? So that's, I mean, I'm really skipping through a lot, but that is the Ned Kelly story in a nutshell. If you try and compare it apples for apples with Squizzy Taylor's stories, he commits about 180 crimes that size, to the point where you get like one crime that is in and of itself big enough for a movie, like I'll use the Thornbury bank heist that he was probably involved with that they couldn't quite pin on him. And really what I'm able to do in this, the context of a book that I want people to be able to read, and I want them to get weighed down with all this information, all I could do is put like a date and then a chunk about that crime and then move to the next one. And I had to choose which crimes I was going to really put some effort into and which ones I had to skirt past. And some of the ways I chose that was things like I'd look at, did this crime have a knock-on effect to other things? Did it have a big court case afterwards? How much of his life did it consume and so forth, right? But I mean, some crazy out there stuff. Like he's alleged to have burnt down the Caulfield Racecourse grandstand and the Launceston grandstand at the racetrack there. Couldn't prove it, so move to the next case. But that's an enormous thing, right? That's a massive work of arson, and he probably did do it. So when I published the book, right, I was going through this phase in probably the second half of the research where I started reaching out to the families of his three wives. Now, he had three wives. The first one was Dolly Gray, and I wasn't even able to find out Dolly Gray's real name before I published. I had only one record where a judge referred to her in the hearing. She'd been stung for sly grog making and prostitution, and the judge said to her, the last time you were here, you were trading under the name Haynes, H-A-I-N-E-S, Haynes. And she was now going under the name Dolly Gray, right? So I knew her last name was Haynes, and that was as close to finding her as I came. So, in saying that, I couldn't also find any evidence that they were married. So, I made this whole book, but in the first marriage portion, I had to say, I found no evidence that they were actually ever married. Almost instantly, straight after it published, a very gracious and very well-known history researcher came to me, and she said to me, look, I have noticed that you said that they weren't married. I will admit it's a very difficult detail to find, but here's the wedding certificate. Now, a few things crossed my mind. I'll just point out at this point. Her name is Deb Robinson. She is the head historian at the Geelong Jail Museum. And in history, you get a lot of gatekeepers, like so many. These are people who have a small little bit of knowledge and they hang on to it because it's going to make them $1 million, right? And they don't share it with anybody. Deb is the opposite. She's the most gracious, kind, nurturing history person in the world, as are a lot of the history people I meet. And her willingness to give me that wedding certificate was incredible. But that's the kind of information that I started to get after I published, right? So then the other part, probably the bigger part, is that in the lead up to publishing, I approached the families of all three of his marriages. And I said, look, my name's Roy. I'm looking at making this book. Didn't hear back from one of them. And it wasn't until right before the publication, I mean like a week and a half before it was set to publish, I had a message from another true crime colleague who does role play games in Melbourne. They're a fantastic setup. And she reached out to me and said, look, I've actually just, by pure coincidence, I bumped into this guy once at Nexpo, and he was Squizzy Taylor's great-grandson. If you give me your details, I'll get him to reach out. So this fellow reached out to me, and he was such a sweet guy. And he and his brother, I've actually become quite close friends with one of them. They were very interested, but I can't tell you how cautious they were, right? And they said, look, we'll come to the launch with Mum. So this is Squizzy's granddaughter. But they said, we won't be able to bring Grandma. I said, what do you mean, Grandma? And they said, well, Squizzy's daughter is alive. She's in her late 90s. And lo and behold, she was exactly the same as so many of the families, just literally traumatized from the life that he gave them. And so, you know, the ethics that I'm committed to in history research, I absolutely understand that. But I was really, you know, blessed to have Squizzy's great-grandsons and his granddaughter at the launch event. Now, having said that, after the book published, one of the other grandsons from his second marriage came to me and he said, look, I can explain why none of the families wanted to talk to you. It's because you're not the first. In the nearly 100 years since his death, there have been a dozen, maybe two dozen people who have said, I'm going to be the one who writes the Squizzy Taylor biography, right? So then they approach the family and they say, right, dig up all your painful memories, give me access to all of your, you know, your, whatever they've got. And again, I want to really stress how traumatized these people were. And they changed their names, they hid from it. And occasionally some of them would say, okay, I'll enter into this, I'll participate. What do you need from me? Whichever author was, you know, grandly going to make this book would sit with them, do the interviews, and then realize the enormity of this work and then put it down. Now, I've got to be honest, right? As a writer, I tend to write between, on a bad day, 500 words, on a good day, 3,000 words. Even by my standards, if I didn't have access to two things, I would never have made the Squizzy Taylor biography, right? It's 430,000 words, right? Verging on 500,000. It's a thick-ass book, is what I'm saying. If I didn't have access to, I'm going to say three things. COVID lockdown was the last part of the editing. My mobile phone gave me the ability to write huge amounts when I'm like on a tram, sitting waiting for my kids to come home from school. Just those moments, those 10 minutes, 15 minutes where you can just add, you can edit like a paragraph, you know. My mobile phone sped up that process and made it possible. And also the ability just to have access to all this data digitally now, that really is the last 2 decades we've had access to this. Really, earnestly, only the last decade, really. We've had really good access to all the newspaper resources that have ever been, right? So with those three things, I was able to draw this together succinctly. So you know, in making that book, I was able to put it out there, and then I had all these people come back to me. But then another group came to me and said things like, my great-great-grandmother was Claude Taylor, that's Squizzy's brother, Claude Taylor's wife, Esther. And did you know that she also shot him in the dick? I thought, nah, surely not. But knowing what to research, because she also told me about an alias that he had, there is the piece. Right at the end of the vendetta, that's what happened, right? So this incredible second layer of information was something I was able to add. And then there were the photos. This time round, I was committed to adding whatever photos I could of any of the people I spoke about. So mugshots where I could, photos of cars, photos of the buildings that I was talking about. And then the last thing I added was an index of every name of every person I came across in the research. So for me, that was a huge step. It was laborious. I had to go through the entire manuscript and keep a log of every single name. And for me, that gave a huge rise to all the different people out there who were able to get hold of the book, skip to the back, alphabetically go through, and look to see if their ancestor is there. Now, that's also been a massive part of it. When I started the research project, to begin with, I set up a few Facebook pages. One was called Squizzy Taylor Stories. So every time I came up with some new information about Squizzy Taylor, anything I could put into a small story, like, you know, 150 words, 300 words, I'd do that, and I'd put it on my own social media, but then I'd also republish it on Squizzy Taylor Stories. By doing that, I cultivated like 1,000 people who dropped in and they'd say, oh yeah, my great-great-grandfather had a friend who had a bookie, who had a roommate, who knew a guy who drank a beer with Squizzy Taylor, right? Now, a lot of those stories are very apocryphal. They're hard to research. Whether they're true or not is a whole other story, but I researched about 1,100 stories like that over the years, and I followed them all up. And what I was doing was comparing a few things. First of all, where was he physically when this story was meant to have happened? So he also wasn't specifically Melbourne-based. He spent a lot of time in regional Australia. We know this because he's arrested there. He goes to New Zealand for the better part of 6 months. So being able to say to people he was in jail at that time, couldn't have done it. But I had one story, for example, come to me, and this fella said, my grandfather said he saw Squizzy Taylor beaten up out the front of the Cherry Tree Hotel, and he pulled a gun out and he shot a guy dead. The truth of it is, Squizzy Taylor was captured because he put his hand behind the till and swiped the banknotes out of the till at the Cherry Tree, and they detained him long enough for the police to arrive. And I'm going to guess in that period of time, they gave him a reasonably sound hiding. Whether he pulled a gun out or not, the newspaper's pretty precise about how they talk about that scenario, and I don't think he pulled a gun out. But all that said, he was absolutely at the Cherry Tree, so there's probably a kernel of truth in it. So I was able to, you know, add little bits like that this person was a witness and he was there. In another very credible instance, there was a family who had a written diary that talked about how Grandma and Grandpa were down the street in North Melbourne, and they walked past two men that they identified as Squizzy Taylor and Snowy Cutmore. Snowy Cutmore slapped Great-Grandma or whoever it was on the backside, and Grandpa, who was a very accomplished boxer, beat the hell out of him. So, you know, being able to add this layer of primary source material was what made me need to then go all the way through it and redo it so I could really tighten up a lot of it. So that book came out in October. And off the back of that, I also began presenting a live event that has taken me 3 or 4 years to also get ready. I've been experimenting with the idea of presenting a one-man presentation where I talk through a whole bunch of true crime stuff that touches upon the subject matter that I specialise in. So my specialty, as you're probably aware, is what we call criminal outsiders. These are the people who aren't male. They're not in that normal age category of 18 to 30. They're not, they're not smash-and-grab impulse crooks. So that limits it down to a smaller group, and they tend to be more along the lines of organised criminals, female criminals, children criminals, the elderly, LGBTQ or queer criminals, blackfellas, people of colour, and people with disabilities. Even in one case, a fella who was a person of short stature. So my passion interest is researching who these people were, what crimes they committed, how they committed them, and wherever I'm able to, also looking at what drove them to that place in the first place, right? With one of the books I published is called The Queerest of Crimes, and it looks at some really harrowing things that talk about the fact that today these people didn't at all commit a crime, but the law back then was such that by living an authentic life, they had committed the crime. So the presentation, the performance they give, I talk about these things. I give a demonstration of weapons, crutches from the Crutchy Push, some of the beer that Bridget Mahoney was making, and razors and all this kind of stuff, right? So I read a few of those, and they were all sellouts. All three shows were sellouts, and I'm now planning two more seasons, one in Melbourne and one in Adelaide for 2024. So that's kind of kept me pretty occupied. And then in the background, I'm also working on three manuscripts in earnest. So I'm working on a second volume of The Colour of Crime, and that's been sponsored by Wathaurong Aboriginal Monk, which is the group who are, you know, kind of that western southern coast of Victoria. And it will be launched at the Ballarat Heritage Festival in May 2024. So I'll also be giving a presentation of The Dawn of Criminal Outsider at that event. But then I'm also working on the biography of Norman Brun. Now, Norman Brun was the Razor Gang leader in Sydney for a period of time, and he's heavily related to the death of Squizzy Taylor. We also think that he was working alongside, and it's difficult to know exactly how he was involved with Squizzy, but from about 1920 to 1925 in Melbourne, he's associated with Snowy Cutmore, Squizzy Taylor, and organised crime. So I'm working in earnest to try and finish that, and my goal is to have that ready for a January launch in Melbourne. Carrying on from that, I've also decided to offer a walking tour. Now, every year I get the same thing. People say, are you going to do a walking tour? Guys, I'm going to tell you a few things, right? These are some background Roy stories. I was in a car accident, like a really bad car accident, at the end of 2019. And it was crippling. Like, this car drove into the back of me at 80k, smashed into my car, sent me flying, and it crushed both my elbows, broke them. I had breaks in bones in both my elbows, a break in my left shoulder, and I still think I had a broken right wrist, and it messed my back and hips up. I didn't get any treatment because at the time I was running my own businesses. I had theatres and a bar, and I just kept doing what I had to do because that's what you do when you own a business. So that involved carrying boxes of beer, wine, setting up tables. It was excruciating. Then lockdowns happened. Now, when lockdowns happened, I realised really how bad it was. I was just living on Voltaren, anti-inflammatories, that kind of thing. So I went to all the doctors and they said, look, you're actually in a bad way, but we can't give you cover because TAC, that's the, for those of you not in Australia, TAC are the road authority who insure you. They denied the claim because they said, you've taken too long, you did it some other way. It's not related to the accident. So I've had to fight TAC. That fight is still going on, and I find it very difficult to walk for long periods of time. So I have sucked it up. I will take a bunch of painkillers and anti-inflammatories. And on January 6th and 7th, I'm doing two Vendetta walking tours through Fitzroy in Victoria. There are limited tickets. I believe the first walking tour has sold out. The second one is about halfway gone. Get your tickets while they last is my key. But that's another thing that's taken up a bit of my time in promoting and planning that. Lastly, I'm heading to Fringe. If you're in Adelaide, I'm taking Criminal Outsider to the Adelaide Fringe in March, late February and March, and I'll be doing three shows there. So three different venues have three different events each. I begin at the Gilbert Hotel in Adelaide on Gilbert Street, ironically. Then I'm at Hotel Metropole across the market for three nights, and then I'm at the Adelaide Jail Museum for 3 days as well. I'll be posting a whole bunch of stuff about that at my Roy Malloy Facebook page, which is Roy Malloy Criminal... Roy Malloy True Crime Author. When they say criminal author, no, depends on what it is, it might not be far from the truth. But I'll be promoting that there. So head over to my Facebook and follow that if you want to see some of the promos. But that's a few things I've got on the boil at the moment. And the last book I'm working on is a biography, a collected biography of the Terrible Ten. Now, the Terrible Ten is a group of 10 policemen. I believe it's probably closer to 15. But these are the guys who were the crack squad who shut down the push gangs. They doggishly pursued Norman Bruin and Squizzy Taylor. And I'm working on that kind of in the background as well. Which brings me to my last project. So the last thing I'm working on is a couple of mates of mine and I, we were talking about how good it would be to be able to meet other content creators. So publishers, blogs, people who run blogs, people who have podcasts, people who have TikTok and, you know, Instagram pages, review books, anything to do with true crime. So we put together an event, and the first one happens, it's a dinner at a pub, an incredible pub in Sydney Road, Brunswick, called the Woodlands Hotel, and we'll be meeting there at 6 p.m. on Monday, 11 December. So on that night, I've got a guest speaker who is the nephew of one of the Terrible Ten, and we've got a granddaughter of another one of the Terrible Ten coming. They'll be bringing artifacts to show us. I'm doing a Q&A with them, and I would love any of you to come, but again, those tickets are limited as well. The link is on my Facebook page, which is Roy Malloy, True Crime Author. And jump on them while you can. But guys, this has been my 21 minutes. All right, so I committed to giving you a half hour. What can I talk about? I will talk about the crutchy push for the next, I'm going to say 9 minutes or close. I might kind of tap out at about the 5 minute mark. But I have been working very hard on some crutchy push material. And I'm looking at making a biography of the crutchy push for later next year. Now, Crutchy Push is a fascinating group because they are a typical push gang. They do the things that push gangs all do well. They have a geographical place that is their patch, right? Their turf, as it were. And it's an intersection where there was a pub called, I'm going to say, off the top of my memory, it's the Britannia Hotel or the British Hotel. And it was on the corner of Abbotsford Street and Arden Street in North Melbourne. Their leader was a guy with the last name Walsh, James Walsh. He had a lot of first names. I think James is probably his authentic name, but his last name was Walsh. I think he had a leg that was withered and half its normal size from polio, but he was certainly using a crutch. Then there was a fella called Valentine Keating, and Valentine Keating is missing half of his right leg from below the knee. I think he lost it splitting big rocks in a quarry or on a train line. So he doesn't have half a leg before the age of 12. That's when we first see him, and he's missing half a leg. Walsh dies at a certain point, and Valentine Keating is accused of killing him. Then what happens is Valentine takes over ownership or leadership of the Crutchy Push. We see an influx of others like them who have half legs or whole legs missing. And you end up with anywhere between 6, and sometimes the estimates are as high as 20 people with disabilities of different kinds, with usually half legs missing in crutches, and in one instance certainly a man called Joseph Gorman who was missing half an arm. Very famously, he would sew a piece of stone, brick or rock into the end of his sleeve where his arm was missing, and he'd swing it around his head like a medieval mace, and that's how he fought. Now, I used the word disabled a second ago, and I want to be really clear on something. These guys were differently able, not disabled. And to qualify that, I'll go through a few scenarios. Valentine Keating was possibly the most bloodthirsty and absolutely dangerous push gang member of any that I've ever come across. He was properly psychotic. One of his key party tricks was to be standing there on the curbside just hanging around. Some poor fool would walk down the street past them, and Keating would smash him in the head with his crutch and split his head open. No provocation whatsoever, and then laugh. So he was genuinely bloodthirsty. The other part of this is that when you say disabled, it means he can't do something. I haven't seen a single thing he can't do at all. Now let's look at the obvious, is running. There's this, one of the earlier scenarios talks about the fact that a policeman takes him aside and is probably going to arrest him. Valentine runs off at full pace in the opposite direction, so fast, in fact, that the policeman on two legs can't catch him. And in court, the policeman refers to him and says, it was like trying to catch a flying kangaroo. So the Crutchy Push are this incredible phenomenon of violence that erupts in North Melbourne 1894 or 5, all the way through until really about 1910 or 11. So I'm starting to do what I call a timeline, which is when you do a timeline, it's you kind of go through all the bits and pieces you have access to. And usually it's newspapers is where you start, and you start just putting down a date, and on the back of the date you put the, you know, the incident, and you try and then underneath that put the names of the people associated with it, and it helps you put a skeleton of the research together. So that's kind of where I'm at with that project at the moment. I think Valentine Keating though fascinates me because he's so heavily and intrinsically linked to Bridget Mahoney, Ted Whiting, Minnie Clark, and the original John Collins. So many of the crooks who were that faction of the Fitzroy Push during the Fitzroy Vendetta, Valentine Keating finds himself right in the thick of it. His marriage to, he married a woman later in life, but his relationship with a woman called Harriet Adderley, which probably resulted in 3 pregnancies, is also another fascinating point because of who she marries, probably to cover it up. So look, that's kind of a snapshot of the Crutchy Push at this point in time. But I do talk heavily about them in Criminal Outsider as well. So again, head over to my Facebook page. I've got a whole bunch of promos for all these things there. If you haven't done so already, I'd love you to check out my books. They are available through a whole bunch of links. But all you've really got to do is write Roy Malloy, author, and then Dawn of Crime or Squizzy Taylor, but also put the word Lulu, L-U-L-U, after my name, and it will come up with my direct link to my publisher. When you buy your books through Lulu, they're 50% cheaper. By the time they reach, I don't know, Amazon sometimes or some of the big bookshops, they're twice the price. So honestly, go to Lulu and check out my books there. Can get them on eBay, but again, look at price before you buy. Thank you so much for following me. If you've got any questions, I love hearing questions. Just send them to me at Facebook. Otherwise, hit the like button or do something nice and subscribe. Thanks, guys.